Tell me your name and where you're from, please.
Art Van Morley. I'm from Marshall, Minnesota.
And can you tell me what capacity you served in World War II?
I was an infantryman in Battle of the Bulge of the 106th Division. We went in early 44 and got out in the end of 45.
Were you drafted or enlisted?
We were drafted.
Do you remember the day you were drafted?
I had taken a couple of deferments while working in a defense plant, making impellers for ships. By the end of 43, I could see that they were going to take us guys my age, although I was married and had two kids already. So I thought, well, we're going to go one of these days anyway. So I didn't ask for the last deferment. So they took me about the end of 43. Then they took me to Camp Robinson, Arkansas for basic training. It was infantry training. They also gave me training for be a clerk typist. And of course, after we got done training, we never saw another typewriter.
How old were you when you were drafted?
22.
And was that considered a little older? You said earlier that when you realized they were going to draft men your age, what?
Yeah, at our age group, they were going to take them. As soon as the invasion started, we knew they were going to need a lot more troops. So I went in then, and we got assigned to an infantry division. And from there, we went to New York. They sent us back for more training to Camp Atterbury, Indiana. We took advanced training, and then the division shipped over in about October of 44. We got to France, we got to England first, and then we went across the channel to Le Havre. And from there, we went up to the front. And it was at that time they had been really rolling across France, and they'd gotten up to the German border, and that was no problems. But then about three bad things happened. We thought the war was going to be over for Christmas, but we ran into this Arnhem Drop, and that kind of backfired. So that didn't work out so good. Then the Hurtgen Force battle got in, took place, and they chewed it about three or four infantry divisions in that. And to top it off, then the Germans brought up three armies undetected. We'll never know how they did it, but they got three armies up there, and they hit us on the 16th of December, which was the start of the Battle of the Bulge. When that hit, we were on the front line, and they started out with an artillery barrage that I never believed was possible. It was a terrific artillery barrage, and we were in a kind of a forested area, but when the barrage ended, there wasn't many trees left. We blew them all off. We didn't know, but we had already been surrounded by the 18th or the 19th. We couldn't get out, we couldn't get supplies in, and we couldn't get the wounded out. And the colonel decided then that he had to do something. So on the 19th, he surrendered the division, but he did give us permission to try to get out if we could. So we, about 60 of us with two half tracks, decided we'd try to get back to Saint-Pith, Belgium, which was our headquarters. And that was about 13 miles back from where we were. We made a run for it, but it didn't take long. The Germans had us at 60 people. They had quite a bit of equipment up by then. They had a lot of tanks up. Cavalry had pulled out a day or so before, so we didn't have any artillery support. But it was pretty hopeless trying to get back, especially with that many people. I think if we broke up smaller groups, we may have gotten some of us back.
You and fellow soldiers, were you considered replacements?
No,
No,
we were
okay.
in a regular division. We got sent up as a division.
And I'm sorry, how many are in a division?
There was about 6,000 in the division. Two regiments of it got surrounded, along with one regiment of the 28th Division.
And how many are in a regiment?
It would be about 2,500. When they surrounded those divisions, they caught us and took us back to a town and kept us overnight. Next day, they marched us all the way to Gerolstein, which is a rail center about 50 miles back. And there they loaded us on boxcars, took us on a long trip to a short distance because they were going real slow, just using the tracks as they had chance to. And I think we were on that train for about 4 days. When that train got to Lindbergh, Germany, they stopped overnight. And while we were stopped, the English bombers came over. The English bombed that night. They came over and they bombed that railroad yard at Lindbergh. And they blew up every car on that train except four. And I was lucky enough to be on one of the cars that didn't get bombed. From there, they repaired it. They repaired the tracks and they repaired stuff up. And they took us on down to Bad Orb, Germany, which is east of Frankfurt, about 30 miles. And on Christmas Day, we got there. They unloaded us. There were so many of us that they couldn't take us all at the camp, Bad Orb. So they took some back. And then they put us in these barracks, which was terribly crowded. It was a barracks mostly for Serb prisoners of war that fought for the Russians. And it was a terrible camp because they gave the Russian prisoners all the worst. And we didn't know it at the time we got there. There was a mass grave. And we didn't know that's why they made room for us. It was they massacred a bunch of Serbs. Put them in a mass grave. We never found out about it until we went back in 90. So then they put us in this camp, and that was lousy. And we had bed bugs, and American soldiers didn't go very well with them when we had bed bugs and lice. We had no bathing facilities. We had the same clothes on we had in October. We kept them on until the end of the war. There was some deaths, mainly from malnutrition and pneumonia. They didn't have any medical supplies. The American doctor that stayed did the best he could, and two chaplains stayed. They did a very good job. They bombed the place once while we were there, but it only killed a couple prisoners. We started hearing artillery fire in March, and the bombers were active around the camp, around their surrounding area, so we knew something was up. And they had warned us then not to try to escape anymore because we would be liberated before too long. Then about the first part of April, the army came up into the town of Bad Orb. They made a deal with the people in the town not to resist. They let the American army go up to the camp then, and they took over in the first week of April. And they liberated us. We had to wait for a while. They took out the wounded and the sick. And then later on, they took us out in trucks. We got on the trucks, and we loaded that up, and they took us to an air base near Frankfurt, Germany. It was a German air base. And there they deloused us, took all our clothes and burned them, and gave us some fresh clothes, some blankets, and stayed overnight there. And the next day, they loaded us on C-47s and hauled us to near Le Havre, France. Camp Lucky Strike, they call it, was for our prisoners of war. Put us there, and about 2 weeks later, they had us all sorted out, and they took the ones that could walk and were physically fit, and they loaded us on trucks, took us back to Le Havre, put us on a boat, and I think it was about 17 days, we made the trip back to the United States, got back to New York, and it was about the 3rd or 4th of June, sorted us out, sent us back home. I trained from there to Chicago, where my wife lived with the kids. She had two little boys, Dennis and Gordon. One was 4 months old, and one was a little over a year old. Of course, she didn't have a phone, but she worked in a defense plant in Chicago. She had the night shift, and when I came home, I got a streetcar. Well, I came up north part of Chicago, I suppose up by Navy Pier, and I caught that streetcar and came home. She didn't know exactly when I'd be home, so we got back at midnight on the 5th of June. Streetcar from the south stopped, and a couple of people got off, and I thought I recognized one of them. And sure enough, we're after about 5 or 6,000 miles in by truck, train, and boat, and streetcar. We met in the middle of Chicago at 12 o'clock at night. Chances of that happening was pretty slim. We got sent back for reassignment to Miami Beach, Florida. When I got back there, they found out I had contacted TB in a prison camp. So they sent me to Denver, where they treated a lot of prisoners of war got sent there. And I spent about 3 months there, I think. And they decided that they had me on the cure good enough, so they sent me home. They were a little leery about it and found the kids. Then they sent me back, and I got home for Christmas, 46.
Your time in the U.S. Army lasted from roughly summer of 44 to you were finally home, done, Christmas of 46?
Yeah.
And your time in the European theater lasted from October 44 to June of 45.
Yeah.
Or, I'm sorry, April of 45.
Yeah, April, actually. The October war lasted 44. A little longer. But they thought the war would be over by Christmas when we came there. But we had those three bad setbacks. The intelligence kind of let us down on some of that because I don't think they realized how tough it was going to be once we hit the German border. The Germans really fought when they hit the German border. And where they got all that equipment, I'll never know. How they brought up three armies. And, well, we had control of the air without us knowing it. We told them something going on back there, but they said, all the Germans got his horses, and those horses sure caused us a lot of trouble.
Was your wife pregnant?
No.
When
no.
you entered?
No, we had, when I left, we had a son a year and 4 months old, and then we had another one 4 months old.
When you left?
Yeah.
Okay.
And she went to work in International Harvester at the defense plant. She worked in a tool crib.
Okay. So you had a son a little over a year old and another son who was still an infant.
Yeah.
When you, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me how you felt when that barrage was happening, when you were in the thick of the battle before you surrendered? What did it feel like to be in that battle, and what thoughts ran through your head?
Well, it was a terrific barrage that started it. And, of course, that was our first really bad barrage. We'd had some action before, but not much. And of course, you're always scared. And it blew a lot of the trees up around us, but not particularly. We were in good foxholes. We actually took over from the 2nd Division that had dug their foxholes. It was a well-fortified front line. But the next day they took us out and we went into an attack, tried to attack the Germans. And they had 10 times the men and material that we had. Plus they could get their supplies in and we couldn't. And we couldn't get our wounded out. And this is what gave our colonel a bad time because I rode with the boxcar with him on the way back. And he agonized all the way back about having to surrender that division. But he said, if I could have got my wounded out, I wouldn't have did it. And I guess that makes sense.
So you were cut off. Your division
we were cut
was
off
cut off completely.
Yeah, yeah. They were 13 miles behind us before we even went into action. That's how fast they got around us.
Can you share with me how it felt to be dug in your foxhole with this terrible, I would imagine, and yet in a way awesome, large artillery barrage. That's what it was, correct?
Yeah.
It was large, taking out
mostly artillery, and there was some what they call screaming meanies. Those were rockets that were fired. They were kind of used to terrify the frontline troops.
And did it work?
I think it worked to some extent. We'd already heard about them before we went in.
What did they sound like?
They made a squealing sound when they were fired.
Like an animal squealing?
Yeah,
or like this?
Yeah, like a bunch of hogs cut under our gate. They really squealed.
Uh-huh.
And they would come in barrages. Not steady, but in barrages. They'd shoot a bunch, and then they'd wait a while, and they'd shoot a bunch more.
Boy, I would think that would be particularly difficult because you didn't know when they were going to stop and start.
Yeah.
That would be even more terrifying.
Yeah.
Do you feel like your training prepared you for what you're going to experience in that foxhole?
Somewhat. I don't think training ever prepares them for actual combat. It gives them a pretty good idea about what might happen, but it doesn't really get down to where it does all a complete job, no. And on top of that, we had the youngest division over there. We had a lot of kids right out of high school. And that's what really hurt, to see those young kids get slaughtered out there.
Perhaps an older man in your division, did you find yourself in the position of having to comfort or guide or help these young ones fresh out of high school?
I don't think we were quite as scared as the young ones were. They were all good soldiers and they all trained, but there's nothing you can do when you get into a trap like that. A lot of German soldiers that we were fighting in that were much younger than ours, some of those kids were only 15, 16, and good soldiers, but they were too young to be there. They should have been home.
I'm wondering if you can describe for me how your feelings may have changed. I'm trying to picture you in this foxhole, this barrage of artillery, the way it must have looked, the way it must have felt. How did you deal with the fear? Did you have a lot of fear, and how did you keep it at bay?
Well, it wasn't much you could do. You didn't want to run. And we were covered with covers over our foxholes. We had made dirt covers over. It was about the safest place you could be under those conditions. But when we got out and see how they destroyed the trees around us, it scared us some more. And then on top of that, my sergeant sent us, me and another kid from Chicago, sent us back to get some food because we hadn't eaten since the night before. And all the way back, the trees were all blown to pieces. And this was in the Siegfried Line. There was some bunkers in there. It was rough country.
Can you tell me again the name of the forest you were in?
Schnee-Eiffel, the Germans called it. Belgians called it the Belgian Ardennes. And it was like the Black Hills, very similar to the Black Hills, with a few roads in there, not very many in those hills. And that's why we thought we were in a safe spot, because there wasn't enough roads to bring armored equipment up, but they did. And they got them up there without us really knowing it.
You felt like you were in the safest place you could be, covered in your foxhole. Mm-hmm. You felt more fear as you saw the destruction of all the trees, and you realized you were in more danger than you had originally thought. So tell me how those feelings changed as surrendered. How did those feelings change?
Well, it kind of surprised us that they would surrender the division, that big a group. Actually, we lost 7,000 soldiers in that out of our division in that war, in that battle. It was an awful lot for one division to absorb. Although there was other divisions that were in there longer that suffered just as many as we did. The divisions that were in the Hurtgen Forest, there were three of them. They were right near us, and there were three divisions chewed up there. Very good divisions. We were very close to where that Malmedy massacre occurred, where they killed a bunch of American soldiers. It's a lot of destruction in a few days.
And that would be very difficult to absorb.
Yeah.
So you said that you were surprised that the whole division was surrendered. How did you go about trying to escape? I believe you said the colonel said there are about 60 of you that could try. And
well, he said any of you guys that don't want to surrender, he said you can try to get back. So a whole bunch of us got together, and we had two half tracks that were running yet. And we got on those, and there wasn't enough room on all of them. But it took us about 60 of them, and we got into another small forest somewhere. And they started shooting what they call tree bursts. And they shoot artillery shells in the trees, and then they explode. That's a bad spot to be in. So we pulled out of there. We're going to make a run for St. Vith, Belgium, which was our headquarters that evening when it got dark. And this was about 4 o'clock, pretty close to dark. When we got out of that forest trying to get away from those tree bursts, then they had us trapped. They knew about where we were going to go. So they had us surrounded. A medic showed the flag up, and that was the end of it for us. Because they would have just slaughtered us in there.
So tell me what was going through your head when they did capture you then and put you in a boxcar. I imagine the boxcar was very cramped.
Yeah, the first place they took us was to a big barn. And they kept us overnight there, was going to keep us overnight. And it got dark, but they brought in a bunch of their horses and they took us out and they put the horses in the barn. So we stood out all night outside, which wasn't all that bad, but because they let us make a fire. But we had a ringside seat of the Battle of the Bulge that night. The rockets, the German rockets were going over us. Artillery shells was going over us. American shells were coming in. We had a ringside seat of that battle that night, setting up on that hill. But nothing hit us on that hill, but we sure, it was a big hill. We could sure see what was going on. And we got on that bus car in Gerolstein, Germany. I think there was about 20 cars. And I know our colonel was really surprised that they could get together that many cars after the beating that they had taken all during the summer, you know. And then we got as far as Lindbergh, Germany, stopped overnight. They stopped several times, but this one time they put us in a switchyard overnight. And about 10, 11 o'clock, we heard bombers come over. And we were kind of happy at first, and we got to thinking, well, we're in a bad spot for bombers. The English were bombed at night. So they bombed them, that rail yard. And blew our train off the track, and that was, I guess, probably the most scared I ever was when those, because you're sitting in a boxcar, you can't get out. We didn't know how bad it was till the next morning, and we see a lot of boxcars was killed. And I happen to have a picture, and I got it with me, that shows the reconnaissance, that picture that they took the next day, the Americans or somebody came over and took a picture of that. And out of those 20 cars, I think there's four or five left. And I was lucky enough to be in one of those cars. That was my first lucky break.
Your first, you had several then. So at some point, did you just decide, I'm going to survive this, and I'm going to do what I have to do to survive this?
Well, I guess most people think they're going to survive it. Most of the soldiers think they're going to survive it. Yeah, I guess I thought somehow or other I'll get out of this mess. We got into one of the worst prison camps in Germany. It was camps for, see, they sorted them according to rank. And of course, we were privates and got into a poor camp. It was a camp that they had Serb prisoners that fought for the Russians, and it wasn't very good conditions. But we kept warm because there were so many in that barracks. Well, there were several barracks, about 20 of them. But the barracks we was in, I think, had about 500 people in it. And that was enough to keep it. Well, I might have frozen there, but it didn't get real cold. We didn't have any fire or any cooking or anything. They fed us like they all did, a little hunk of bread and a bowl of soup every day.
Did you get fed once a day?
We got a soup at noon, and then about 4 or 5 o'clock, they gave us a little loaf of bread they cut in 7 pieces, I think it was, or 6 pieces. And then we subdivided that into little pieces for ourselves. And what was the worst part of the whole experience probably was all the GIs could talk about was food. And they was always making up recipes with delicious food in it. And here we're sitting there eating that soup and that old hard bread. Part of it was sawdust. It was some sawdust mixed in with barley, I believe. And all they could talk about was food, and the hungrier they got, the more about they talked about food. You never heard such recipes they made up. One guy wrote home to his mother. He said, "Mother, I'm doing okay. Please send me," and the rest of the card was all filled out with food that he, rich food that he wanted.
Can you share one of those recipes with me? Do you still remember them?
Well, chocolate covered everything. Everything was chocolate covered. And a lot of bacon, because you're always hungry for something like that. But if you could think of a rich recipe, that was it. And I remember two guys got their bread one day, and they each had a little jackknife. And they would always slice it in little fine slivers. And they eat one sliver at a time, so it would last an hour. And they got in an argument. And one guy couldn't figure out what the other guy was mad at. Well, he was mad because the other guy had cut his bread into more slivers than he did. So his lasted longer. That was the mindset that you got when you was hungry, you know.
So how did you make it through the day in this prison camp? What did you do to keep mentally and physically strong in the way that you needed to survive?
There wasn't much activity. It was so crowded that you couldn't have much going on. There was a little card playing, but not much. I went outside and tried to exercise, but I found out after about 3 weeks that I couldn't run no more. But I'd still go outside and exercise. By the end of February, the weather got nicer, and then we could go out and walk around outside. In 1990, our son from Kansas City and his wife took us back, took me back, and we visited the old camp. And it had been a Hitler youth camp before we got there, before the Serbs got there. And it was a rough buildings. And when we got back there, they had torn down most of the buildings, but they kept about five or six. They resided them, painted them, and planted trees in there. And it was a beautiful sighting. The trees were beautiful, and that was in Bavaria. And that's beautiful country. And we never realized how pretty it was till we got back there. It sure didn't look pretty to us when they walked us up that long old hill from Bad Orb that night. When I was taking basic training in Little Rock, Arkansas, I had to stand guard duty one night, so they gave me a kid that had refused to fire on the rifle range. And it was a young guy. And I had to take him around and water the trees. It was a hot, hot night. So we watered the trees, and he talked all the time. He was telling me why he was scared to fire the rifle. And when it got done, he asked me if I'd buy him some ice cream. I guess I wasn't supposed to do it, but I bought him a quart of ice cream. He had to go back to that hot place where they had him. And, you know, I never knew who that kid was until I read a book after the war. It was The Execution of Private Eddie Slovak. And he was the only kid that was the only soldier that was executed for not going into he wouldn't go into the foxholes. And that was a kid that was guarding that night. And he actually was a nice kid, never should have been sent to the infantry, never should have been sent to the front, but he was. And I was really surprised when I read that book and found out that was the kid.
Were you able to communicate with your family at all while you were held?
They gave us letters and cards to send back to our families, but we thought that was all a joke. We didn't think, as messed up as that deal was, that they would ever get them. But they did get a few. My wife never got notified that I was a prisoner until March. The telegram never got through until March that I was a prisoner, because everything was messed up in Germany. And so she didn't know whether she had a husband or not until March. And then about a month later, they got another one and said I'd be on my way home after we got liberated. But she worked in the defense plant, did a good job, and my kids didn't know me when I got home.
I bet they had grown and changed
a lot.
Oh,
sure, yeah. You know, the little guy was walking, and he didn't think that I should be there, I guess, but... That was to be expected, you know.
I want to go back to the camp and this idea of, you said you had some lucky breaks, and it sounds like you did, but also this idea of what kept you going. This might be difficult, but if you can, in your mind, go back to the most difficult day you had in the POW camp, you can describe it for me. If you can go back to that, you can describe it for me if you want to. If you can't, that's okay, but can you tell me what got you through that day?
Well, the worst day was when one of the GIs got out of the barracks at night, and he went down to where they made the soup, and he found some meat, and he took a meat cleaver and cut a chunk off and started frying it, and the German guard came around and smelled the meat. He went in, and this kid took the meat cleaver to the German guard. Well, that didn't go over very good with the Germans. So the next day they got us out, and it was a cold, cold day in January. And they lined us up, and they said, okay, we want to know who did that. And of course, nobody will squeal on another GI. So they said, okay, we're going to shoot 10 of you every hour until we find out who it is. Well, the chaplain stepped forward then, and they said, give us a while to see what we can do. And somebody found a bloody jacket. And in order to save a bunch, they turned him over. I don't know if the Germans ever executed him or not, but that was pretty scary until that thing got settled. In fact, and then they didn't feed us until it got settled. And I think that was probably the roughest day. It was pretty cold standing out there. We had already froze our feet twice that winter, and we didn't need to be froze again.
When that day was over, and it had been resolved as well as it could be in that setting, did you make any promises to yourself? Things like, if I survive this, or when I get home, I will do something or not do something. Or do you know what I mean? Did you make any promises to yourself?
Well, I think we all did, in a sense, you know. We thought, if we ever get out of this deal, we're going to be darn thankful. And we'll never hope to get into something like this again. But that was all out of our control. It's an experience, of course, you never forget. But at that age, you can really take a lot of stuff like that when you're that young. The ones that it really got, well, we could see it right away in prison camp, were the older guys, guys in their 30s and maybe 40. They didn't take it like the young kids did, because they always had hopes they were going to get out of it. The older guys weren't so sure.
They didn't have that youthful
outlook on life.
Or that feeling that, you know, when you're young, you think you're invincible.
Oh, sure.
And they knew better.
Yeah.
Mm. Can you tell me, Art, how you think your war experience changed you?
Well, I think it makes you appreciate some of the better things in life, and it sure made us appreciate good food. I sure didn't go much for that kind of food anymore. It's one of the things that they did that really helped us after we got out was when they sent us back on the boat, whoever run that deal understood what to do. He fed us oatmeal all the way home, and it tasted just sweeter, just really sweet, because we hadn't had any sugar all winter. And by the time we got home, our stomachs were in pretty good shape, and we had gained a lot of weight. I think I weighed 120 or something like that when I got out, and I had gained about 10 pounds by the time I got home on that slow boat ride. And my health has been pretty good since.
Except for the TB that you contracted. Do you remember the first thing you either thought or said when you saw your wife again?
Well, I was so surprised when she got off of that streetcar, and I thought, boy, that looks like Lucille. And of course, it was dark, middle of the night. And so she took off. We lived about a half a block up the street. So she took off real fast for going up the street, and she was getting away from me, and I was carrying a duffel bag. And I hollered Lucille, and she turned around. Yeah, I was pretty happy.
Do you remember what she said to you?
Well, I think she just said, Art, and she put me, knocked me over.
What would you like someone like me, who only knows of World War II through things like Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers, what would you like someone to know or understand about World War II?
Well, it was a very costly war, of course. That's everybody knows that. And it was so many young divisions that got chewed up over there in Europe and in the Pacific. My younger brother was in Okinawa, and he had a rough battle there. That was a real rough. Actually, there was five of us boys in from our family.
Really?
Yeah.
How many siblings did you have total in your family?
There were 13 in my folks' family. And five of the
Not
boys.
Not for a baseball team.
Five of the boys went. Yeah, I always said our mother said a lot of rosaries. But we all came back. I was the only one that got a scratch.
There were five of you in the war.
Yeah.
Were any of your brothers close to you geographically?
No. One of the brothers was in the air in England in the Air Force.
Okay.
He was the closest, and I got to visit him just before I went over. He gave me a leather jacket, and I wore that thing all during prison camp.
Oh, I bet you were thankful for that
Oh,
jacket.
was that a godsend?
Talk about a lucky break before you even knew you needed one. So he
I
was in
couldn't have
England.
cried when Americans threw that on that fire and burned it. I was going to take it home. It was all lousy,
So you had a brother in England, you were in Belgium and Germany, you had a brother in Okinawa. Where were the other two?
The other one other one was in Hawaii. There were two of them in Marines. They enlisted together, and they promised them they'd stay together. And after they got done basic training, one went to Okinawa and Guadalcanal, and the other one went to Hawaii and never left. Never saw each other until the war was over, and they were back in Minnesota. Then the oldest brother, he went in. He never did leave the States. He was in about almost 5 years. Spent most of it in California, in a motor pool.
Wow, so just very a variety of experiences, war experiences in this one family. So, okay, this really will be my last question, I promise. But tell me what that was like when the five of you had were reunited for the first time.
Yeah, I guess that was in fall of 46. We had a family reunion, and of course there were times we didn't think we was going to see each other, but it was a pretty happy time. We drank a lot of beer that Sunday.
Did you tell a lot of stories?
Oh yeah, it was there was lots of stories. They were all a little different, of course, but we were essentially a band of brothers, I guess, that day.
Well, Art, is there anything else you'd like to share with me before we wrap this up? Anything else that you would like people today to know about the war and your experience?
Well, it was a terrible experience, and it was costly for especially for your infantry divisions that lost all those people. But I tell you, we believed in it, and we were willing to do it. And I just hope that they get to come to our senses and stay out of those kind of things.
Well, thank you so much, Art, for visiting with me today. And
Thank you.
thank you for your service to our country.
Well, there was a lot of them that did it.